We'd like to welcome you to this first meeting of the C.S. Lewis Society of Chattanooga for the year of our Lord 2008. My name's David Beckman. I'm the moderator of the society, and since we're in a new location, and also since many of you all have not been to any of our meetings before, let me just briefly tell you that we started the society 3 years ago, almost to the day. It was January the 21st of 2005, and the society was begun, and it continues as a ministry of the church of which I'm a vicar, St. Andrew's Anglican Church. It meets here in Chattanooga, and we've usually met in the vicarage, okay, our house in St. Elmo, that we also tried a coffee shop in St. Elmo as well, and we usually take from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. to talk about different books of C.S. Lewis, and we've done some other things too. Some of y'all may have heard about the conference that we had a while back with Lyle Dorsett at the Chattanoogan, and in seeking another venue, it was suggested that we meet here at Rock Point Books, and we really do appreciate the hospitality of the people here at Rock Point, letting us be here and helping us out and dragging chairs around and all those other sorts of things. It's really great. We thank you very much. We do not have an official membership, but we do have an email list. And so if you would like to be on our email list, just let me know. Or you can send an email to me. If you go to our website, you can find a link to me there. And the website is easy to find. You just look up C.S. Lewis Chattanooga, you know, on a search engine. It'll come right up. I did that tonight on Yahoo. It was the first five or six things on there. And I thought, oh, I didn't know we had so much stuff going on. And the address is just cslewischattanooga.org. And do visit the site regularly, because I'm all the time putting stuff on there that relates to C.S. Lewis, not just about the society, but things I think that you all would be interested in if you do like Lewis, and things that have to do with the Inklings and so forth. Now, you'll want to plan to be at our next meeting. It's only going to be three weeks away, February the 8th. It's the second Friday in February. We're going to have Dr. Debbie Higgins here to speak with us. She is an English professor at Southern Adventist University. And she spent the last year or so, I think it was like the summer and then the whole school year of last school year, living at the Kilns, which is was the home of C.S. Lewis in near Headington area, north of Oxford. And she did that while she was working on her doctoral dissertation, which was about Anglo-Saxon mead hall customs, which happens to be a thing that J.R.R. Tolkien was very interested in, which he used, and Lewis liked that kind of stuff too. So at any rate, that's February the 8th, and at 7 p.m. again. And she has a PowerPoint presentation that she wants to be able to show of the Kilns. But we need a projector. So if you have any idea where we can get, you know, borrow, rent, whatever, one of those projectors, or you hook up to a computer and show the PowerPoint presentation on the screen, then please let me know, because we need one. Because it'd be nice to see the pictures and talk to her about it. She had a lot of really neat experiences. She was there while Douglas Gresham came by showing some of his relatives the house, which was kind of cool. She's a great lady, and I'm really looking forward to having her here with us. Now, tonight, we're going to talk about a subject that was very near and dear to C.S. Lewis and his friends, and our hope is that is going to help us to appreciate the mind and writings of Lewis better. And we've titled this evening's discussion, Story, Imagination and Faith. In other words, can stories, especially certain kinds of stories, do to help our imagination and our Christian faith? And to help us to discuss this tonight, fanfare, I've invited my friend Art Crouch to be with us. Art is an elder at Reformed Presbyterian Church, and he has been studying in preparation of a Sunday school series on fairy tales and the Christian faith. And our plan tonight is to take this book here, which is one of the books that he's been studying, Talking of Dragons by William Newsom, and use it as our jumping off point, using some of the main things that he's interested in this book as a way to get the discussion started. And we'll talk about this theme of imagination and faith and story for about a half hour, 40 minutes or so. And then we'll open up the floor and you can join in with us, and we'll go till 8 o'clock or so. And then the formal part of the program will be over, but you can feel free to remain and to visit with one another and keep talking about the topic with one another or with us. And you certainly want to browse the bookstore here, and especially if you haven't been here before. And there is a table of Lewis books if you didn't see it back there as you first come in, so you want to check that out to see what they have. So then, all right, thanks for coming tonight.
Glad to be here.
And I thought that perhaps the best thing to do would just be to start out introducing people to this particular book, helping them to understand just what it's about.
Okay. When David approached me about this topic, we struggled a little while for how we were going to get started. And I had done a series on Narnia during the summer and came across this book very late in the series, but found it to be quite illuminating. And the reason I suggested this is what Newsom is getting at is the book is written for adults, specifically targeting parents, and trying to teach parents how to develop imagination in their children. So he breaks down, first of all, fairy tales, story, myth. Those words can be used sort of interchangeably in the talk, as well as on the other side, you'll hear terms like materialism, rationalism, mechanism, scientific mechanism, those kind of terms, which would be probably an alternate pole to the fairy tale side of things. So Newsom's goal is to get parents reading two men that he said imagine truth for us in their writings, and that was Tolkien and Lewis. And he breaks down some of the background, how they came up with some of their stories, some of the childhood and life experiences that led them to these stories. And it really opens it up and makes an interesting introduction. If you haven't read much of Lewis and Tolkien, it's a good way to start into that. And we'll reference a number of other books that we've read and discussed over the years that if you're interested, you can take a look at as well.
Okay. Well, now, why does he think that parents should be concerned about the development of the imagination of their children? What's the reason for that?
Imagination plays a critical role in faith, developing the faith of the child. Imagination, and there are a number of authors from George MacDonald, who was an influence on Lewis, who argue that you have to have imagination to be able to understand truth, to be able to understand beauty, to be able to understand goodness. Newsom argues from the standpoint of the scripture itself, looking at the Bible as myth, or the true myth, as Lewis called it, in that there are things there that you cannot understand necessarily if you're taking the rationalistic, I've got to see it to believe it viewpoint. Imagination is a requirement in faith. So he argues that elements of the Bible, especially some of the poetic elements, read like fairy tales. There are references there to witches and dragons and giants and unicorns in the scripture itself, and therefore fairy tales, myth, provide a nice platform for teaching children especially that there's something bigger than themselves out there, that there's an unseen world, and therefore we need to embrace that because it is reality.
But isn't it deeper than just kids need to read fairy tales so they'll know what dragons and giants and unicorns are, so that they can understand these allusions in the Bible? There's more under the surface than that, isn't there?
Well, sure. There's that the idea of imagining truth. And that goes deeper. That was Lewis's, talked about George MacDonald as one who baptized his imagination. And by that, he meant that MacDonald imagined holiness for him. There's not a fantasy or a fantastic in an unbelievable sense, but bringing holiness into reality for him. In the same way, fairy tales, myths, can help us see a different spectrum of the great story. The great story is the gospel. It is the Bible. And all story, Chesterton argues, relates back to the story. And it either tells the truth about it or it tells a lie about it. So all story helps us to look at the scripture and the gospel story in different ways. It helps open our eyes to different ways of seeing.
You know, I think one of the important things for us to recognize is that the Christian faith is built on a story, mm-hmm. not just propositions.
Yes.
You know, we have, it's not just, you know, religious data of things that that we believe. You know, philosophically, you know, a lot of theology can get like that. You know, what are the attributes of God and you know, what is the nature of the hypostatic union of Christ and these sorts of things. But when it comes to the creed, the Apostles' Creed, you're reciting a story is what you're doing. You go from creation, incarnation, new creation, and the work of the Spirit and bringing these things to pass in our lives and in history. So the Christian faith is fundamentally, it's just a story of who Jesus was, just like Jesus himself said. You know, read the Bible. It's just, it's all about me, you know, from beginning to end. So the fact that human history is really a story, because, you know, that's the most important thing about everything that's happening, is it's all about Christ, ultimately. So human history and under the providence of God, and, of course, the story of God's plan of salvation, it is this big narrative, this structured narrative. It's got a plan to it. It's got a beginning and an end. And like Tolkien talks about in his essay on fairy tales, you know, it has a happy ending. And that's how he makes a connection with fairy tales to the Christian story, in that, you know, fairy tales are a way of getting into just the whole idea of the basic things that are in the Christian story. So, you know, it's just that, you know, I think there's a lot of Christians that don't even think about Christianity being a faith in a story.
A fairy tale.
But it's true is the point. It's a true story.
Yeah. Lewis says that it was the myth that became fact, or the
yeah.
myth that was fact. Mm-hmm. We're built for story, and that's the way we communicate. I mean, there was a reason why Christ himself taught in parables. He taught in stories. He didn't understand, he understood, but he rebuked Nicodemus, you know, you're a ruler in Israel and you don't understand these things, when he told him that he needed to be born again. Nicodemus was thinking rationalistically of, you know, how can I be born again when I'm
yeah.
older?
Yeah.
Story helps you, again, understand things in new ways. Chesterton talked about us being little words, you know, the word aspect of story is important to how we're built. Images and story, if you read through Talking of Dragons, you see the difference between Lewis and Tolkien, in that they came at stories in a different way, but they were both getting at the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they had that famous discussion that they don't write stories like that we like anymore, so we'll have to do it. With Tolkien, it was from a word or a name. For Lewis, he was dealing in images always. He would then communicate basically what he was seeing in his mind and his imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what is important in teaching children, especially, is you want to guide them in their imagination so that they don't stray to the fantastic side. Try to materialize the imagination, and instead of going down the path where you get lost in the fantasy, you get lost in the truth of the story. And there's quite a divergence there as they get older. They learn to embrace truth, or as Barfield said of Lewis, he was always willing to be enchanted. You know, God give us children that are willing to be enchanted and see the truth in things that, again, is much beyond ourselves, that's in that invisible world.
So that there are fairy tales that, well, I'm sure there are fairy tales that communicate false things, or fairy tales that aren't really wholesome, that aren't really developing the kind of imagination, mm-hmm. sympathy and stuff you want. But then there are fairy tales that are about profoundly true things, so that I forget where it was. I don't know if it was in this book or another, where they're talking about how fairy tales are, they're fiction, but they're not fiction, you know, because the subject matter that they're dealing with, or the kind of world that you're confronted with, you know, there's the things about it that are true in our world. It's, you know, they really are true things. And
I think it's Newsom, and maybe I'm getting him confused with Chesterton, I've been reading both, who talks about, back to the idea of all stories apply to the story, and they either tell the truth or tell a lie about it. Mm-hmm. And there are things that can be gleaned from that, but it does take some discernment on the part of parents to guide children to the right kind of stories. I'm constantly amazed in looking at the story of Sleeping Beauty. You know, it's a nice summary of the gospel. Someone who is cursed at death, or cursed at birth with death, but that death is softened by the ministrations of a fairy godmother who mm-hmm. was kind, and only can be wakened from that sleep, lifeless sleep, by the prince coming to save her, who truly loves her. And it's one of the movies that Disney got right. You know, the great scene at the end where the prince shows up and he's fighting the fiery dragon mm-hmm. in the remnants of what was the garden that's now thorns because of the fall. Mm-hmm. And he fights his way to the princess and gives her life. It's certainly a good picture of the gospel, and one that children can resonate with. And that's the kind of thing that you want to look for, not get lost in, are there dragons or are there goblins or something like that in it, but what's the message of the story? What's really being taught here? Chesterton and MacDonald both would argue that fairy tales don't have to be made up. They can be true. You can, you know, tell your children the story of, was it Horatius on the bridge or Cincinnatus, and you get that sense of what you're pointing them toward. There's an ideal type, as Hicks would argue, that you want to keep presenting to your children so that they can then mirror that. And it's not something you can define. You know, can you define nobility? Well, it's like defining the color green or the smell of a rose or the taste of a really good cup of tea. There's things that you know that you can't necessarily articulate in a very, I won't say a systematic manner, but a very mechanistic, rational, succinct manner. There's just an essence there that is known because you know it. And that kind of knowledge, that depth of knowledge, of not knowing about something but knowing the thing itself, is another aspect of what fairy tales can teach. They can teach you aspects of nobility or courage that a realistic story just can't touch, because it doesn't resonate viscerally with us. I won't even say emotionally, because it's even more core, I think, than the emotions. And those kind of stories stick with children. In Orthodoxy, Chesterton talks about the one thing that he believed as a child, and he still believes, is fairy tales. He knew about the Man of the Moon before he knew there was a moon. He knew about Jack and the Beanstalk before he even knew what beans were. And he referred to fairy tales as that sunny country of common sense. There's something there that everybody knows. And he talks of legend and says, you know, legend is created by the entire community, whereas the book's written by the one guy who's crazy. So you have to be careful what you read and point your kids in the right direction.
So Newsom is saying that we ought to be sure that our children are reading fairy tales, but yes, they would be good fairy tales, for the sake of the health of their Christian faith as they develop and as they
absolutely
grow. And what you're saying is that fairy tales can communicate things that are true and that are real and that are beautiful to us, that say, you know, a catechism, say, might, you know, would not do. Isn't there also an experiential factor too? I mean, aren't we also talking about developing sympathies? Because, you know, we've been talking about how it is that stories can communicate truth in a way that that other ways of communicating can't. Okay, and we've also been talking about the fact that, you know, there's the Christian story is the true story. It's the way things really are, and that truth can be mirrored in stories that people have written. But that's sort of informational. How about in terms of development of sympathies and tastes? I don't think Newsom gets into that quite so much.
He doesn't
there something about that, though, in this?
I think that reading the right sorts of stories, in the Narnia books, that topic comes up a lot, that in the Don Treader, for example, Eustace is critiqued for not having read the right kind of stories. Mm-hmm, you know, he doesn't know what a dragon is because he hasn't read the right kind of stories. His parents sent him to kind of a goofy school because they haven't read the right kind of stories. I think there's something to the overall development as you embrace the imaginative side, the poetic side. Things resonate, you know, not just odd concepts, but compassion. I can remember as a family reading Where the Red Fern Grows, and if you've never read it, by the end of the book, we're bawling our eyes out. We were on a trip. I think I had to pull over because my eyes were streaming. We're all crying, and you know, anybody that looked at us would go, "Why are you crying?" Well, there was more going on there because of the development of the story than just a single event. It was a life-changing thing for the protagonist in the story. Children can respond to things like The Velveteen Rabbit or The Giving Tree, some of those books that impact you at a visceral level, and when you later reflect on them, what are you learning? You're learning about things like giving of yourself. You're learning about what is real and what isn't, what love is, what does it feel like. Things that words would fail us if we were trying to specifically define, this is what love looks like. You can't do that. The story has to speak the entirety of what it has to say, and that gives you an aspect. That doesn't give you everything. It gives you an aspect of that story or that attribute that you're shooting for. And continually reading good books to your children or having them, trying to instill in them a love of reading themselves will help them see those attributes, those gifts, if you will, themselves and embrace them because they've seen the models set before them. In Norms and Nobility, David Hicks argues for the ideal type from the ancients. If you set that ideal type before a young child over and over again, they will naturally want to mimic that ideal type. So you put good stories before your children that are telling aspects of the story and telling the truth about the story, then they will learn and want to model that.
The so imaginative literature can, as a person, child or adult, reads the story. The thing that a good imaginative story will do is it will transport your imagination. And of course, you yourself emotionally too, as you get into the story, as we say, into an experience outside of yourself, can be a completely other world. And so that as, let's say, a child is, or reading, The Princess and Curdie or whatever, when the goblins are about to get, the Curdie, and you feel fear. You're afraid. The adrenaline starts to pump or whatever. But when everything works out at the end, there's happiness. It's the you catastrophe that Tolkien talks about. The happy ending has taken place, and it's the good guys that are winning in that story. You see, so that there's an experience of joy and of gladness of seeing people who were right and good conquering wrong. And so what you're saying is that can not only provide ideals, like you can see the courage of Curdie, and the virtue and innocence of the princess, those are ideals that the children can emulate. But it's through the imagination the child's also been able to be there to a certain degree. in a way that, and this is where Newsom comes in a way that reading Bible stories could not, because Bible stories are so close to the world that we're in.
It does, I believe it was Tolkien that used the term myth or fairy stories wash our windows. It gives us a way of seeing, because we can wander in another world, mm-hmm. we can look at a sunrise on Perelandra, for example, and then relate that back. It gives us an ability to see our own world. That story might be a good example of Perelandra gives you a vision, if you will, of what Eden was like before the fall, mm-hmm. Where the inhabitants don't even understand what evil is. And then a whisperer comes in, and it's much easier for me to then go to the scripture and read the story of the garden and the fall and understand how that could happen. You know, it's easy for us to step back because we've got all the endings in place and you know, judge Adam and Eve. Perelandra helps you step back and go, well, what if it wasn't a one-time thing, but this had been going on for a while? You can see how the wiles of the devil would be able to accomplish those ends. So wandering, if you will, in another world gives us a much clearer picture of our own world, and it helps us, it breaks down those barriers that prevent us from being able to look at ourselves. We can look at another character if we identify with them. We can then turn that and say, wait a minute, what is it saying about me as well? How do I think in these situations? You know, you find yourself agreeing with one of the characters in the story to find out that they're wrong. And you've been cheering them along all the way through, and you go, oops, wait a minute, maybe I need to rethink what I'm doing and how I'm thinking about these types of situations.
You and I, a while back, were talking about this. We're talking about kinds of truth, and we've been hitting this off mm-hmm. and on. We keep hitting it, you know. There's there is the truth that is, you know, propositional, deals directly with our minds, and there's the kind that's not propositional. It's poetic, to use Jim mm-hmm. Taylor's terms, and Owen Barfield's terminology, and so forth. Right. It's stuff that you know more intuitively. As you interact with it in more of a non-rational way, which story does that? Poetry does that as well. In fact, Newsom mm-hmm. says, you know, poetry includes poetry in it, in his discussion. But we were imagining, we were talking about how it is, and this because Newsom brought this up, the way the Apostle John ends his gospel. You remember that?
Yeah.
When he says that, you know, if everything were recorded that Jesus ever did, you know, it'd take a whole world full of books to write it all down. Yeah. There are many other things that he did. Now, when he says that, when you're reading the Gospel of John and he says that, immediately your imagination goes boom. You know, you start thinking, wow, you know, all the things Jesus would have done, and how much we don't know about, so that it excites your imagination. Just him saying that to us, mm-hmm. and. what does that do for us? You know, why did he do that? You know, and we were thinking, well, one thing it does is it awakens wonder. You know, it's not saying, you know, Jesus is man and God, and Jesus was here from, you know, 0 AD or 3, 4 BC or whatever it was, until such and such, and he did this, and he did that, and he did that. It's done in a poetic way. It's done in an imaginative way. You know, just think, you know, what it must have been like. And so wonder is awakened in the heart, but it's not, you know, it wasn't done in a rational way. And wonder isn't a rational thing, really. Right. It's you know, yeah. What is it?
It points you to the magnitude of you know, what Christ did during that time.
It communicates truth. Jesus is wonderful.
Right.
You know?
But it also puts you in the, the comedian Mark Lowry has a routine where he goes, you know, what would it have been like to have been Jesus' brother? And his parents always going, why can't you be like Jesus? He's perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a tough gig for a younger sibling. But it helps us understand something there as well. You know, he's making light of it, but it's speaking a truth of, okay, Jesus was perfect. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. what kind of pressure would that have put on his siblings or those that knew him? I think that contemplating, you know, the world wouldn't hold the books that could be written of all that Jesus did. That's true. Because all of it on that plane wasn't even seen.
And that's true, too.
And what wasn't seen? Mm-hmm. You know, your mind can go off. And I think that sense of the awesomeness and the awfulness of God, which are terms that we've kind of lost the real depth of, the majesty and the magnitude of Christ's ministry on earth, I think open up to us. And again, I think in story, it's much easier to communicate those kinds of things than if you tried to list, you know, a daily diary of everything Christ did.
Yeah.
We probably would kind of glass over because of some of the repetitiveness and then spots of wonder.
Yeah, but, you know, and I think this is Newsom's concern. If you're raised with a prosaic soul, you know, to where, you know, you just can't get into anything imaginative at all, would that passage in John touch you and excite that wonder? Are you open to it? Because I think what Newsom is saying is that we have to have the imaginative in us stirred up, sort of like we teeth on fairy tales, so that we can then go to the Bible and be ready to find that which is wonderful, imaginative, things that move our souls, not just move our minds. Is kind of what he's getting at.
Well, I think that I'm reminded of Lewis's comment that what he believed about anything, he wrote about in everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's I think about the Narnia books in particular and how much of theology you can glean from those books. The way the characters interact, the situations that they find themselves drawn into, and there's no necessary preaching or anything like that. It's a simple telling of a story, and your mind is immediately led to what Lewis wants you to be thinking about. You bring where you are. I mean, if you take someone who has had no training, they've never read anything but strict nonfiction textbook type things, they're going to have a more difficult time. But he addressed that in the character of Eustace, again, in the Don Treader. Eustace was fond of looking at books that had pictures of farm machinery and, you know, tubby children in model schools, obviously talking about the Soviet system. And he didn't have any context to understand what was going on around him. He was thrown into something. And I think what Lewis was saying was, go ahead and jump through the picture. Try this out and see what you'll learn.
Well, see, I run into that at school. I have students who, the reason they cannot understand why they need to study Latin is because I'm going into business. I'm thinking, fine, but what kind of person are you going to be?
Right.
You're not even thinking about that.
Can you think?
You know? Yeah. Can you think? Or, you know, what is going to be the nature of, you know, what kind of a soul are you going to have? You know, are you just going to read tech manuals, or are you ever going to read the Aeneid? You know. Of course, some of them probably say, probably not. You know, but, you know, it's just a lack of a sympathy there. Of course, Plato talks about this in the Republic, you know, the need to cultivate sympathies correctly. And I think Plato had a lot of good things to say about that. But getting back to the Narnia stuff, mm-hmm. you know, Lewis, he is here in when he's talking about fairy stories, he talks about the process by which he wrote the Narnia books. Now, that's something we found was a little bit of a fault with Newsom,
right.
Because Newsom was limiting. He was painting the picture of Lewis writing the Narnia books by just having pictures of things coming into his head, you know, the fawn with the umbrella and the lion jumping in, these sorts of things. And then he just sort of pieced all these pictures together. But he tells us in his fairy stories thing that, you know, that's where it started. It began with these images, and he tried to think, well, what am I going to do with these? But then, as he says, came the form, which was something he says, the form excludes, let's see, and the moment I thought of, he's got these pictures, but then what form is he going to use? He says, well, I'm going to use the fairy tale form, is what he does. And then he says, then, of course, the man in me began to have his turn, and I'll just read it. It's a Lewis Society meeting, you read Lewis. I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings, and reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices, almost as if it were something medical. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. And so what he's talking about here is sympathy. Mm-hmm. Whereas a person's feelings could be frozen about being involved in the story that they're in. How about we put them in another world, another story, let them through their imagination experience that world and that story to where they start thinking, you know, this thing about, you know, having an adventurous faith in this dying and rising God and so forth, that's kind of cool, you know, and then jump back into this world. And then through Tolkien's theory of recovery, you know, realize, you know, start to where you have your sentiments are more open to the Christian story, because that's what Lewis is saying here. I want people to not have the problem that I had, that their sentiments are open to Christianity. But then he also, in another place, and I don't have it from me here, talks about how I found, it is in this book, but how I found that I could teach theology through stories too, which is more the content thing, which is what you were talking about.
Yeah.
So that, you know, stories are able to provide both content and also affect our sympathies.
Yeah, somewhere near there, he also talks about the disparate images, and then he had to apply the discipline of creating the story
yeah.
to it. It's not a random throwing together of all kind of crazy concepts.
Yeah.
There's a definite line of thought that he is on mm-hmm. to bring all this together.
That's where Michael Ward's new book comes in.
Yeah, which
yeah, sort of a meta. You know,
well, he does address. He talks about Aslan, the lion leaping into the story, and you know he started The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with basically two images in his mind. One was a fawn walking through a snowy wood with an umbrella and armload of packages, and the other was a white queen and a sled being drawn by reindeer and driven mm-hmm. by an elf or a dwarf. The lion aspect came, he said, from wondering if there was a godlike character that incarnated, if you will, in this world, what would he look like? And he started having dreams of lions. And so Aslan burst on the scene. And many people asked him, you know, how do you come up with this stuff? And he was kind of offended at the idea of you come up with it. It just happened to him again. He was thinking through what logically should happen in a world like this. George MacDonald in The Fantastic Imagination says that when an author creates a world, they have the freedom to create the world however they want, but laws must be in place in that world or the story is basically unbelievable. And Lewis was following that formula
yeah.
of his mentor and saying, okay, in this world, what would the Christ-type creature look like in this world? And therefore, it was a lion, a talking lion, and not a tame lion, as mm-hmm. they go over and
yeah.
over again to talk
yeah.
about.
Well, time is moving on. Does anybody have anything they want to say or contribute or ask or about this topic? What's your experience? Oh, yes, please.
How about how he came to write the story? One interesting thing, too, I just recently realized, of course, he got the children to call him, and he started that because he housed some poor orphans. And he talked about that. Of course, he had not, being there at Oxford, being a professor, being a bachelor, he didn't hear a lot of the children. But of course, he remembered his childhood. And so as he was trying to have a friendship and a relationship with his children, talking to them, he enjoyed talking about books and stories. So he asked them, what kind of stories do you like to read? And he was talking about, saying, well, he read these fairy stories, different ones, and he was just shocked and flabbergasted to find out that they had basically read none. They had not read anything. And so he thought, what a tragedy that is. He remembered how, that just made his childhood so wonderful, those stories and having a friend to share those stories with. And he thought, what a tragedy that they didn't. So that was also one aspect I remember, that he deliberately set out to say, I'm going to write stories, fairy tale type stories for the children, and to help them.
Yeah, Newcomb brings that on in his book. He shows how Tolkien was writing stories for his kids, and then Lewis was writing stories for, kids that he knew, which really is a very, human aspect of it. That it's a very personal thing, that there were specific kids that they had in mind that they were interested in entertaining and enlarging their world endearing.
In the dedication of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he dedicates it to Lucy. And in that he says, I know that you're probably too old for fairy tales now, but someday you won't be. And he himself said that he read fairy tales at the age of 7, and he would have been ashamed if anybody knew, but at age 50 he read them and he didn't care if anybody knew. So it just showed kind of his growth in that as well, and he was passing that along.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I think there is a danger in retelling stories without understanding. What I have seen is especially young authors who have embraced a genre, but they don't understand the craft. They take aspects from different characters and there's one that y'all would all know who takes a lot of aspects from a lot of different writers, but doesn't understand the point. So there's really nothing to say other than to tell a story and then that's it. But they don't really finish the story. There's not a learning experience. Nobody's really growing. There's nothing that you can react to at a core level. And I think that's sad, but it's probably more out of ignorance than anything else, and it's not understanding, not having been taught and not grasping it on their own.
Yeah, I think it started with Clint Eastwood. The good and the bad and the ugly. wasn't John Wayne told Clint Eastwood, I don't like your movies?
Yeah.
Because it was a change of sympathy. Instead of it being, the guy riding off in the sunset on a white horse and a white hat, it was just this guy that just was, he started out miserable and he ended miserable and everybody else was miserable, and that's a good story. It's just a cultural thing. The Bible talks about woe be those who call good evil and evil good. There is a spiritual force active in the world seeking to persuade people that evil is what will make you happy instead of what's good. And our sympathies get perverted. And that's why it's so important for the church, and I put it at the feet of the church, not the politicians or whatever, we are helping our people to understand what is true and what is good, and not be caught up with all the other trappings and things that we do, so that we are affecting a generation's sympathies understand that what is good is what you want, not what is bad. Or, you know, or just people just are so confused. You know, they don't even know what's good or bad. I mean, people walking around, they haven't even fantasy idea. I remember one time, I forget where I was. It was during one of the Reagan elections. I think it was Reagan and maybe it was Mondale. You know, it was one of these situations where you had two candidates, and they were just completely different. And this person said, you know, I just don't know who to vote for. I just can't make up my mind. And I'm thinking, you know, not, you know, who was right or who was wrong, but, you know, you've got these completely different polls, and you know. There was a hand back there in the back. Yeah.
Yeah, there's at the end of every chapter, he has a section called Family Activities, and he encourages parents to work with their kids to write stories, to tell stories. If you grew up in a storytelling culture, I grew up, and every time there was a family gathering, you know, my time was spent sitting around listening to stories. There was a man near where I lived out on a farm in the country, who was the son of a slave. He was, he must have been in his late 90s when I knew him. But the stories that he could tell would just hold me spellbound even as a small child. So, you know, telling stories to your children, sharing stories with your children, giving them a passion for stories, you know, develop it in yourself, and then you can communicate that. My love of reading, I read little as a youngster, but it really came alive when I was in college and I took a literature class, and most of it was poetry, and I didn't really care for poetry except, you know, corny limericks or something like that. And this professor, I didn't like the types of things that he read, but he had such a passion for what he read. After like two classes, I was in the bookstore spending all my spending money buying books that I wanted to read because I wanted that same kind of passion about what I was reading. And so you can instill that just in your enthusiasm as you read to your children. And, you know, if they want to read the same book 500 times, read it to them 500 times. They'll recite it back to you about 50 into that or less. My kids can still recite books back to me.
Yeah, let's hear them. Come on. No, I won't do that to you. Yeah, Matt.
I got a question on the impact of the storyteller in the role that they play. I've heard you both talk about how important for the parent to be the child. Now, what about someone who doesn't have that parent-child? Is the impact as significant with the development of the imagination, or is there something about the transference of the passion?
Well, you don't have to be a parent to transfer that passion. You know, a teacher can do that. You know, you can do it within your church, working with small kids or older kids.
There's a significant influence.
We have some friends who we've known for 12 years, something like that. We've known their son since he was a toddler. And when they'd come over, I used to read stories to him. And he'd be embarrassed if he was here for me to say this, but he still will show up at my house sometimes with a book and, you know, will you read this chapter or read this story to me again?
So that maybe the impact of someone in the community going to the inner city schools and reading to the middle schoolers might be a pretty significant way of a Christian mentality.
Could be. I mean, it's going to depend on the situation, the person, the fertility of the soil that you're going to try and work with, but any chance to convey the truth of the story, you know, is an opportunity that could be seized.
Yeah.
Flesh out a little bit more the relationship between imagination and faith. You know, a lot of
associated with the fictitious, whereas here we are embracing true history on a fantastic level, and it's bringing awe and I guess the wonder in history as opposed to a fictitious world.
Yeah, there's a if you have never heard of it, Ken Myers is a gentleman who lives up in Virginia who does a Mars Hill audio series. He does it in the style of a All Things Considered. And a while back, he had an interview with a professor from Wheaton College, Alan Jacobs, where they talked about that idea of the fantastic versus the true. And it came from a question on what did Lewis mean when he said that George MacDonald baptized his imagination. And he said there's two ways of looking at it. There's the fantastic, that is just the made up, fanciful out there that doesn't really have any grounding, and the eichastic, which is what is good and true and beautiful. That idea of imagining holiness, again, it doesn't necessarily apply to the characters or the situations in the story. You read Lewis, and you know you're doing interplanetary travel to, you know, Venus and Mars, and then you also have the Narnia series that are very imaginative, in a whole different world that's not our own. But there's a causeway, if you will, between our world and that, and the characters that are involved. You know, you have all manner of characters. So it's not the character, it's the content. What is it that's being communicated, and what's really behind the story? So, you know, you take a tale, again, like one I referenced a while ago, where they have all the trappings. You know, they have dragons and elves and wizards and all that kind of stuff going on, but yet there's not really continuity of story, there's not truth being told about the story, then you've got a problem. And those kind of books tend to be more flash in the pan, and then they go away because they don't have the sticking power of being read over and over and over again and revealing new things. I reread the Narnia books at least once a year, sometimes twice, and I have for, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, and I still get something new out of them. There's something else that's revealed. And those kinds of stories are the classics that you can embrace, because they're going to keep revealing, you know, new layers for you. Did that answer your question?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I think a factor in answering this question has to do with what you all were saying earlier about the two kinds of ways that we process truth, one being compositional truth.
Intuitive
or imaginative truth. And I think in response to this, and in terms of the idea of the holy, about this, there are a couple places where Lewis talks about the passage in The Wind in the Willows, where Rat and Mole encounter Pan, and talks about that as embodying a sense of the numinous, of the holy. And Lewis doesn't mean there that this is an accurate propositional definition of a holy. We're talking about Pan, which is sort of this mythological being in a beast fable, what Tolkien calls a beast fable. And yet, for Lewis, there is the communication through that passage of the truth of holiness more abstractly that can prepare the heart of the reader for real holiness, and an encounter with real holiness when that's possible. So there's a lot in Lewis about the preparation of the heart with that which is not literally true, so that the heart is ready to encounter that which is literally true when that encounter comes.
Yeah. Or enlarge it. I mean, that's something that I keep thinking about, this in a psychological kind of way. I don't like psychology, but just the you know, what's happening to you and then it being transferred over into your life. I don't know how many of you all could say the same sort of thing, but I have found my reading of fantasy literature, well, certain kinds, MacDonald, Tolkien, Lewis, and so forth, as something that has enlarged my heart in my Christian faith. You know, Paul tells us that we are to love the appearance of Christ. You know, we are to be longing for the coming of Christ. Well, now see, that is something about your affections, right? And if your affections, you know, your affections need to be developed to love and to long for something. And I found in my own experience that, you know, walking across the shadow lands and up the rainbow to the real world in the McDonald's Golden Key, mm-hmm. or sailing over into Aslan's land with Reepy Cheep, or sailing into the true west with Frodo, that, you know, as I wept, you know, with the beauty, you know, and that sad longing and so forth that's involved in those imaginative experiences. Well, because the underlying story in those stories is the true story of this world, then the application is immediate. It's just boom, like that, you see, so that my affections are being aroused and enlarged. And then I wake up into the real world and I realize, okay, you know, that's where I'm going. It's like that, you know. I have a land that I'm heading for. And the Holy Spirit has so awakened my longing and desire for that, sometimes it's just consuming, you know. But I point it back not to Bible reading, but to reading The Return of the King and stuff like that. Yes, sir.
Kind of related to all these last few questions we had and the comments about, you know, good and bad fairy stories and all, is, you know, what does Newsom say? And one question being the standard question, a common question. Well, there shouldn't be any magic. The magic is just bad because it's not true. And you know, we should never a Christian children great reading about magic, the Bible speaks against that or whatever.
I'll take that on two fronts. One, Douglas Gresham has a quote that says, you know, when people start arguing against magic, they don't understand the etymology of magic came from the same word as magi, which we call wisdom. That's one area of looking at it. If you read Chesterton, he'll say that the reason that, you know, the crops come in the autumn is not because of anything scientific, but it's magic. And if you can't understand that, then you got a problem. So, you know, the aspect of magic, what is magic's role? There's even a distinction in some critics, I guess you'd say, between incantational magic and invocational magic. Incantational magic is singing along with the creation. It's more a part of the world, whereas invocational is calling something from outside and trying to bend it to your will. Usually it winds up having its own will and you pay the ultimate price for it. But there's a very stout difference between those two. And so as you evaluate the use of magic in literature, look at whether it's incantational or invocational. Is it just part of the natural world? If you look at, well, in The Lord of the Rings, It's part of the natural world that wizards can do certain things, elves can do certain things. They speak to the water. It's similar to the old tales. Chesterton says the modern poets want to sing about bushes and trees. Well, the old Greeks couldn't see the trees for the dryads. You know, there's something magical about the world if we're willing to open our eyes and take a look at it. So I hope that answers.
No, I mean, God's magic is just great.
Yeah.
He said the world, and like you said, the flowers or rainbow, anything. Just God's magic. How does that, you know, so, and he said when your kids ask you, well, how does that happen? What makes, you know, the flowers grow or what made this? Or, and, you know, he said the best or fundamental or great answer is this, it's God's magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's different ways of defining magic. And it also helps to understand how stories are made, too, and just the nature of literature. I mean, just because a book talks about wizards and about, you know, ghosts or about, you know, mediums or whatever, like the Bible, doesn't mean that it's a book that's trying to encourage, you know, it's the logical fallacy of accidents, right? Isn't that right, girls? Accidents, isn't that what you mean? Accidents? You know, I have to ask my logic students. The, you know, where there happens to be characteristics about two different things that are shared, but that doesn't mean that they're the same thing. They're just an accidental, a coincidental similarity. So just because those words are there doesn't mean this is a book that's trying to get people into the occult. Okay, you know, it's just the world that's there so that you can get on with the story. It's the story is the point. You know, everything else is just support. You know, the main thing is the story. Anything else you want to chime in on or ask or anything? Well, it's getting after 8 o'clock, and so we should probably move on from here.
Okay.
But be happy to talk with you about any of this stuff at your leisure. And again, our website, cslewischattanooga.org, and you know, have a look and let's stay in touch. So have a good rest of the night. Come back February the 8th, and we'll look forward to having you. And be praying.